So thanks so much for agreeing to talk to us. We do appreciate it.
No worries.
So I was wondering if I could drill down on some stuff. I've had a lengthy chat to Scott and to Pat, and it's been terrific as a kind of an overview. But you know us, we love to sort of delve into a bit more of the specifics to kind of get some insight into the amazing work you guys have done.
Sure.
One of the first questions I had for you, which is maybe something that you can answer, I'm not quite sure, but it just struck me when I was pondering stuff this morning that the look of the Transformers is a bit more heroically robotic and a little less like the component cars that they transform from in this film. In other words, Optimus Prime looks a little bit like he's made up with windshield wipers on stuff and a bit more like metallic. And I was wondering, is that me or is that a deliberate decision at your end?
Well, the design of the robots, I do know that we started out with something that was a little similar to the third look, and we knew we needed to go a little bit farther from there to make them look more detailed, more battle damaged, just better than before. So there was an effort to make them look certainly more heroic, and there's even a character, the Knight Optimus, and as a knight in shining armor, Knights of the Round Table.
Yep.
And it kind of started with there, and it cascaded to the rest of the characters. And just having that really heavy, detailed, feature-rich look to the robots was a conscious effort on our part.
So in terms of the approach to the CG characters this time versus previously, where are we in terms of the, for example, ILM pipeline? What I'm getting at is, I presume this is a physically plausible, physically based shading model. Was that the case last time? Where are we in terms of like the transition of the technology?
So we are certainly using much more physically based rendering models this time. We're even using physically based rendering in our volumetrics. It's something we acquired halfway through the show.
Wow.
We started the show with physically based hard surface shaders, and then we moved on to the volumetrics. So as the movie went on, we started incorporating more of that. But in the third movie, there was more of a selective process as to when we turn on the very accurate reflection tracing and different indirect lighting models. On this show, we just found ourselves turning it on more and more, and by the end, it was just a default. It's turn it all on. We've got the processors. We need the look to really hold up from shot to shot, so we're not going to really cut any corners on this show.
So if we take a character like, I don't know, just at random, like a bumblebee or somebody, what is it that you're finding in having a physically based shading lighting model that's working? Is it that the look is the same but it's easier to get there, or is it that you actually feel like the look is sort of better and different?
It's a little bit of both. We certainly could have gotten very, very close with some traditional models and cheating in a lot of different areas. But that would have required a lot of artist time. And, you know, our artist time is getting to be a very rare commodity at this point. So with the number of shots we have and the limited artist pool, sometimes it just makes more sense to turn on the more expensive clock cycles and let some of the shaders do a lot of that harder work for us. Now, even when we turn on all those bells and whistles, there is some fine-tuning to be sure. And we certainly hit that in a lot of shots.
So I'm presuming that if you're going in to light a shot, and I'm going to stay with Bumblebee just for argument's sake, if you've got an HDR, that's not a bad place to start. But then, of course, a character that's a hero in any form, be it an actor or a robot, is going to have, you know, hero lighting. Is that the approach?
Absolutely. Every shot starts by default with some HDRI lighting spheres, and that's just kind of our baseline to see, all right, where does the environment lighting get us and how integrated to the plate is it? And a lot of times it's very well integrated on the first take, but it doesn't have that artistic punch that we really need, especially for a Michael Bay film. So then we start tuning some of the accent lights and mirror boards and different lights that really bring it out of the screen to the audience.
So if you've got a character like Bumblebee that's way up in the air in, say, Hong Kong, are you making your own? I mean, do the artists like often just sort of paint up their own HDR image-based lighting spheres to sort of feed that start process? Because you obviously wouldn't have one, as opposed to on the ground, of course, where you could just record one.
We do have some higher up lighting spheres from the top of buildings, and for those we tend to paint out the building underneath, so we're pretty much most of the way there for a lot of aerials.
So you said that you'd gone to image-based lighting on the volumetrics. That's a sort of serious step up. What were you looking to sort of gain by doing that?
We wanted to get a better integration with the hard surface lighting as well as with the background plates. So, for example, with a lot of our really thick smoke simulations, we would have, you know, a rim light that made the smoke very well defined, but we can never really get light into the crevices, especially from the front views. And we found out by using Houdini's Mantra on Pacific Rim that we were able to just bring out so much more detail with an environment light, but the performance was really, really slow, and we can only use it in a few shots. So we had one of our engineers implement a physically based lighting model in our Plume software. So we had hardware accelerated GPU based volume sim and renderer doing the physically based lighting for us, and that was an incredible win. We were able to get, especially on the new generation of hardware, we were able to do image-based lighting with volumes at the same speed as regular spotlight volumes on the older hardware.
Wow. I mean, Plume is incredibly fast at the, you know, in the old kind of sphere, but the thought of being able to take it to that next level. So you mean like new graphics card? Is that what you mean by new hardware? That's like, presumably it's got more RAM and stuff that allows you to pull this off?
Yes, we went from 4 gig cards to 6 and 12 gig cards. But the newer generation of GPU cores, from our benchmarks, we found, you know, apples to apples, a sim on the older hardware versus the newer hardware runs 5 times faster on the newer hardware. So we're able to get through more iterations.
So if you've got a lot of bots interacting in, say, Hong Kong, and you're adding a lot of atmosphere and effects and smoke and stuff, it would seem like this would be a good candidate for a deep pipeline. Was it a deep data pipeline?
Oh, yes, by all means. We couldn't have gotten this show done with a traditional like 2D holdout pipeline. We had to go deep on this to make it work. And in the beginning, we made a conscious decision to be selective about which shots go deep so we wouldn't fill our shot disks, so we wouldn't burden the compositors. But what we found is we had to pull the trigger on more and more shots, and by the end of the show, we expanded our disk space and had some more processors for compositors, and we ended up just going mostly deep. And the compositors ended up doing a lot of pre-comps. So they would merge all of the volumetric deep layers and then save that out and then do a lot of color tweaks and integration on top of that.
Because, I mean, apart from anything else, this is a stereo pipe, so getting stuff placed accurately in Z space is absolutely critical, not just for the look, but for actually making the shot work.
Yes. Our compositing department really saved us in many ways. We have some of the most talented compositors in the world, and in the effects department, we could not get our job done were it not for the talents of the compositing department. So in some cases, we just didn't either have the time or the resources to populate the scene with certain effects, and in those cases, the compositors were able to layer in elements in 3D, and that really helped us out a lot. And in many cases, the effects simulation supervisor on the show, in fact, in every case, I encouraged our effects TDs to collaborate with the compositors and help design where the lines are drawn between what is a 3D effect simulation and what is a composited element. And because Nuke has such powerful 3D capabilities, those lines were blurred in many areas.
So can you give me the sort of rundown of the scope of the stuff that your team was doing? Because obviously we think of it as being kind of smoke and dust and stuff down in Hong Kong, but there's, I imagine, a ton of stuff, for example, up on the ship, for example, or when lockdown takes Optimus Prime up, or the, you know. I just wonder if I could get some kind of idea of the range of the work that your team had to deliver.
Right. It was pretty diverse on this show, especially. Now, I could go through the basics. There was, I guess I could describe it as 5 main categories, and the one that had the most presence on the show was ground interaction. And we really wanted to convey how heavy and massive and present these robots are, so especially the Dinobots. And when they were walking on the ground, they would crack the pavement. When they were running, they would kick up mounds of dust. When they fell down, they would eject a wave of dust and debris and rocks and soot into the air. And we developed a very streamlined procedure for identifying the intersection of the characters in the ground planes. And that would generate, through a series of automated procedures, collision bodies, emitters for instance debris, for little dirt particulate, for volumetrics. And that was all rendered in deep, and it was able to be composited in deep. And that's one of the biggest wins for the deep compositing, was a lot of the ground interaction. So that was the first category. Second category was building destruction, and that's always been one of our crown jewels. We, as FXTDs, love to do building destruction. Our rigids team are specializing in just rigid-based destruction, where they use flesh sims, cloth sims, rigid sims. They layer in lots of different methods of simulation to convey bending, twisting metal, vibrations of the structure of a building, glass shattering, different I-beams snapping. And in the effects TDs, we'll layer in all of the different secondary simulations on that, whether it's glass sims, glass particulate, or debris, concrete debris and dust, lots of fireballs. We can't get enough fireballs, especially when a Dinobot is scraping up a building. So that was the second category, building destruction. Third category for this film was a new one for us, and that was part of the magnetic pole sequence. So this spaceship that's flying over Hong Kong has a magnetic weapon, and it can lift up any weight of an object that's not anchored to the ground. So it lifts up ferry boats, cars, buses, and then it just drops them all over surrounding our heroes. So they have to run away to avoid getting smashed by, you know, a 20-ton ferry boat or a bus or a gigantic billboard that is the size of a building roof. And then one of the other main categories is robot damage. So there's a lot of robot violence in here. And when a robot gets sliced in half, that's when the effects team jumps in and we layer in a shower of mechanical parts. We just eject bolts and panels and circuits. We shoot out sparks. We shoot out white smoke. And if it's a bad guy, they shoot out like this antifreeze liquid. So it's kind of like robot blood. And then the last effects category that I kind of describe in this show is pretty much what you were mentioning at the start of the question, which is populating the interior of these spaceships and making them come to life. Instead of just a solid surface background, we layered in rising steam vents or falling mist, kind of like pockets of dry ice, showers of sparks, water drips, pockets of smoke floating in the air. So it was a way of giving dimensionality as the camera flies through smoke. And a lot of character to the spaceship.
Yeah, I think that kind of stuff can maybe be overlooked sometimes, but it adds tremendous production value to a shot to sort of populate a otherwise it's an empty set and it really doesn't have a lot of character, does it?
Yeah, and in many ways we're trying to mimic what would happen on set. So there were limited sets where the heroes of the film would just walk around set and act out with proxies for the robots, as if a robot was walking next to them. And when they're on set, they're shooting sparks, they're lighting flashes, they're dropping dry ice or drips of water, and we need to bring that same level of character in our CG environments and set extensions.
Your destruction pipeline, which you know served you so well in so many instances, is it an extension of that you're using this time? Is there anything new in that destruction pipeline? Because obviously its ability to deal with incredibly complex sequences is sort of, you know, well, it's first class in industry. Like, it's amazing.
Yeah, so the destruction pipeline we have, is it continues to be refined, and we're certainly building on the past, but we had to take it to the next level yet again, especially for a Michael Bay film. And We've multi-threaded a lot of our front-end simulations. So the rigid simulations, they're still layered, but our machines are more powerful and the software is more multi-threaded. So we can layer in more detail at each stage and preview it almost in real time in many cases. And that's when I say the front end, basically taking a model, fracturing it, and then running the different types of hard surface simulation, whether it's a rigid body or a flesh sim or a cloth sim. And a lot of these are mixed together, like I said, to get that bending, twisting, ripping metal effect. And in the effects pipeline, we have open VDB collisions now. So that's given us the ability to get much more detail in about the same amount of memory and computational expense. So getting open VDB into our proprietary pipeline as well as our third-party software where we can exchange data has helped artists as well. And I guess the biggest win was the new capabilities we got for Plume with the physically based lighting model as well as the expanded memory in some of the newer generation graphics cards.
Yeah, the Open VDB, I'd always sort of, I mean, I really hadn't thought of it as much in terms of its impact on a destruction pipeline. I'd sort of thought of it much more in terms of, you know, sparse giant sets. But of course, it would be incredibly relevant, wouldn't it?
Yeah, it was able to capture very fine details on our robots. So there's a sequence where Grimlock, the T-Rex, gets punched by Optimus Prime, and he goes tumbling into the forest, and you see this very hero close-up of his face covering, you know, the whole frame, and there's little rocks, little streams of debris pouring off every little crevice, and it's because of OpenVDB that we were able to capture all of his facial detail in a volumetric collision, whereas before we would have to rely on just planar polygon collisions, and those never really work out as well.
In terms of the dynamic fracturing and stuff, is it still based off a Veroni sort of fracturing sort of approach, or because it's not based off a finite element analysis or anything like that, is it?
No. And as far as I'm aware, we pre-fracture pretty much everything except for glass in certain cases. But you know, all of our hero fractured simulations are pre-fractured in, you know, a very art-directed manner, so we can actually control the aesthetic of the crack patterns and where we find the finer details in the larger chunks.
So one of the most difficult parts about any of that destruction sim stuff, it would seem, especially when you've got the characters and stuff, is really accurate collision detection and being able to have, you know, very accurate collision detection. Obviously, you can get broad collision detection when there's just stuff falling on a ground plane like the street. But once you start getting characters busting through stuff, is that a complex problem, or has that been changed at all in the last film?
I think it's pretty well handled by the effects collisions. And to go back to your question about level sets, you know, I just realized we still use level set volumes for the front end, where we do our levels, where we do our flesh sims and cloth sims and rigid sims. It's on the back end of the pipeline where we use the open VDBs, and that's where the collision accuracy comes into play. When a character comes really close to camera and you want to see pebbles and little tiny particulate bouncing off its surfaces. The open VDBs in the back end of our pipeline, that's, I believe we don't have open VDBs on the front end because the front end is still a FISDAM solver, and that's based on LSVs.
Right. So in terms of rendering, we've discussed Plume, which is terrific, being a GPU kind of approach. But for the non-Plume stuff, do you have a renderer preference? I mean, some of the stuff you mentioned, Houdini, I presume that would feed into a Mantra or a RenderMan pipe. But I don't know, what are you rendering? What do you like to render with?
In the effects TD department, we are blend between Plume, RenderMan, and Mantra. So in Mantra, we try to use that software to its strength, and Houdini has a really nice workflow for prototyping different looks through volumetrics. And in Houdini and Mantra, we used that to generate our volumetric thrusters and our heat ripple setup. And there were a lot of spaceship shots in this movie where we see thrusters and heat ripple. So one of our artists prototyped the look of that thruster in Houdini, and he did it just in a couple of days. It was really fast. And another artist spent the next week or two just wrapping it up into a template for everybody else to use. And for a lot of the destruction type rendering, whether it's instance debris or point-based particulate, our renderer of choice is RenderMan, but we also have artists that use Mantra as well. And that comes down to training. If an artist has enough time, we train them up on a proprietary Xeno software, and through that they'll use RenderMan for effects. But later in the show, we've kind of run out of time to train somebody up on the proprietary software, so we let them use what they know best, and that's Houdini.
So the volumetric stuff that we were talking about before that was using physically placed lighting, is that dependent?
Yes.
I mean, is that any renderer, or is that just something that's only happening in RenderMan?
That's something that we're currently only using in Plume, but it's actively being developed for RenderMan. We just don't have the RenderMan shader set yet. It's an active development right now.
Yeah, I mean, it's a heck of a juggling job, isn't it? Getting the right tools for the right job, but also then dealing with the huge volume. I mean, in one sense, you'd want to just standardize on something because you've got so much stuff to get through. And on another, you know, to get the right tool for the right job. Is it like establishing the kind of pipeline and mixing these various tools? Was that an issue, or was it just on a shop-by-shop basis?
It's a combination of the type of effect and what the artist we have knows best. So if an artist is faster at one tool versus the other, and they can match the look of the sequence in less time, we let them use whatever tools works best for them. In most cases, though, we prefer an artist to get trained up on the assets, the effects templates, for that particular effect or sequence or shot. As I said, on Transformers, we had a ton of shots, and it was a heavily back-ended show, so we had a pretty short schedule and a lot of work to do. So we brought in some artists very late in the game, and like I said, we did not have time to train them in Xeno, so we just had them run things that may have had an existing asset and template in Xeno, but they didn't have time to learn that, so they just redeveloped something very quick and prototyped it in Houdini for maybe less productivity, but it helped us get the job done.
So a lot of the stuff we've been discussing, you know, you'd kind of think at first glance that it's going to be procedural based because so much of the destruction stuff is simulation. But for something like the magnetic pulse, I'm just wondering, like, that has to be art directed very carefully because it's got a purpose and it's trying to kind of tell the audience what's going on. But, I mean, has to be built out of a simulation at some level. So what are the controls like? I'm just trying to get a feeling for that procedural versus artist interaction.
So the magnetic pulse sequence had a very simplistic simulation basis. It was usually just a point-based particle simulation for the bulk of the process work, and we instanced different metallic geometry onto those points and gave them a, you know, rotation, a lift, or a fall. And we had a few hero pieces that were right in front of the camera. In that case, it wouldn't be an instanced point-based asset. It would really just be a hero asset with a car kind of rolling up and the car door flipping open, or a bus kind of lifting right off the ground and something falling out of it, or a boat lifting off the ground and lots of metallic things rising up faster than the boat and non-metallic things falling out of the boat, like people in one case. So we had digital doubles falling out of a few boats that were rising up out of the harbor.
Yeah, I mean, it's instancing is a terrific thing, especially in terms of what you can do with a good renderer with instancing. But it certainly sounds like a complex interaction of, like, I mean, those falling bodies, are they kind of like ragdoll sims? I guess they are, right?
They were, yes. In every case, we had them. And it would really have to be close enough for you to identify that it's a person. And if it was close enough for that, it certainly would warrant a ragdoll sim.
So how big was the team at its sort of maximum that you had?
I know I was directly supervising on the effects simulation side about 40 artists between San Francisco and Vancouver. We had another team who was independently working out of Singapore. They would check in every day, but they had a lot of autonomy in terms of the art direction and the iteration cycle they had.
And just finishing up, I am fascinated by your comment earlier about the robot damage and just spewing out nuts and bolts and stuff. I mean, that sounds very casual, but like presumably you did have to kind of art direct the damage per type of creature, because I mean, you know, at one end you've got creatures that are doing very distinctive things in this film we've never seen before, especially the ones from the KSI and that have the you know, particle based stuff, and at the other end you've got, you know, more traditional damage being done to our hero characters like Optimus Prime. I mean, surely you kind of skipped over it, but that robot damage is, it's an art form in of itself.
Yeah, we put a lot of effort into art directing each bullet hit. So whether it was a little tiny spritz of sparks that lasted 3 or 4 frames, or if it was a shower of sparks and smoke and fire. In one case, Optimus Prime, actually in a couple of cases, he took missiles from a villain called Lockdown and took a missile right through the chest a couple of times. In that case, it was just showers of sparks, fire, smoke, and we ran fluid simulations for that to make it feel more integrated. But a lot of the bad guys had, like I said, the liquids in addition to it. So none of the good guys would spew liquids, but the bad guys had tons of antifreeze leaking out because they were just getting slaughtered by the end. So there were Lockdown henchmen on the main spaceship that were getting shot by the main human characters. And there were the KSI robots, the human-made and controlled robots that were getting killed by Hound and Optimus and the Dinobots at the end.
Yeah, there's some nice crunching of bots by those Dinobots, kind of a T-Rex crunch thing, Optimus throwing characters and getting them bitten. They must have been quite a lot of fun to do.
Oh, yeah. Every artist had a lot of fun doing this. It was... The work was fast and furious, but it certainly was fun.
When you're approaching the KSI, you know, Transformers, did you start with the robotic transformation or the lab transformation? I was just trying to get an idea which one fed which in terms of process.
So there's a new type of transformation, the hypno-transformations. That is certainly the nearest and dearest to my area. That was the hardest thing, I think, that this facility has done in years. The hypno-transformation took... a very high skill level in the areas of technical expertise, artistic vision and communication, and open-mindedness as well. So we didn't have that many shots of hypno-transformations, but it took a small team of our most skilled artists the entire show to figure it out. There's two demonstrations of the hypno-transform. One of them is when Stanley Tucci holds up this ball of transformium and it pops out of his hand and then kind of explodes into cubes and wires and has a mind of its own. That was the first problem we attacked because that was the first shot we had. In fact, we had a turnover of that sequence pretty early on. And it went through a very exhaustive iterative cycle. And it was very hard to determine the look because there really was no reference for that. It was kind of an open-ended look. And as many things as we tried, it was very difficult to nail something that captured what we were trying to achieve with the story as well as, you know, something that was aesthetically pleasing and interesting to the viewer.
Right.
And I should say that we had one shot that just wouldn't go away. It was the first transformium shot, and we just kept going around and around. And when we realized it was just too hard to make progress on that, we took a step back and we designed the whole sequence. And we said, all right, this is the progression. So instead of starting in the middle, let's start from the beginning and let's keep the rest in mind and let's block it out. And that's how we were able to establish the look of the transformium on a smaller scale. And then we started getting the full-scale transformation shots after that.
So how much was that sort of a multi-layered sort of approach? I mean, how much was that sort of coming out looking like it was out of the actual renderer? Because it's incredibly complicated. I mean, for a start, there's the kind of like the particle-y bits, there's the wire bits, there's this kind of, I mean, it's not just one style of look.
Yeah, I guess we can break down the hypno-transform into those two subjects, like I was mentioning. One of them would be the small-scale demonstration, the other would be the large-scale. So for the small-scale little ball of transformium, the look was driven really by a lot of hand controlled simulation parameters. So we would set up basic building blocks through animation, and those would drive different transforms that would be like a lattice cage. It had a little bit of wobble to it, and lots of channel massaging to give it the right squash and stretch and pull and lag. And without a lot of that hand tuning, we just couldn't get that look, that hypnotic feel to it. Now, for the large scale stuff, I mentioned that was the hardest thing we've ever done, because we went through so many different looks before we arrived at what eventually was a successful presentation of the idea. So what you didn't see was all the failures along the way, and there were a lot of them, but we were really happy with the final look in the end. It was just a very expensive, tedious process to get there. And by the end of the movie, though, it was a very fast, iterative cycle because it was so highly optimized. Now we have a very good understanding of how to do that, but it's still no easier to get a really good look out of it.
So to get back to that previous question, though, there was sort of presumably separate things feeding off the same underlying directed animation. Like, there were various sims that sort of came together. I'm just trying to get a feeling for how much you had to get that put together and looked, making the look work in comp, and how much was it just coming out of the animation when you hit the render button?
In terms of the integration, we got a lot of it through at least the lighting part of it. There was material exploration. We used our physically based lighting for that. And there was certainly some comp massaging to get us there. But the raw renders did have a really integrated look to them. But it really took, like I said, a skilled compositor to get the final look out of the polished, surfacing and integrated lighting to it. The animation was certainly the hardest part, though. And we had three different cycles to that. For the animation cycles, there was the disassembly, there was the strands, the tendrils that traveled through space, and then there was the reassembly. And each one had its own challenges to it. But to get there, we had to simplify each step and just do a point-based representation of what the disassembly timing would look like, where it would travel through in space. We had another artist that actually specialized in those tendrils that flew through space that were made up of cubes and had different wave patterns traveling through them. And then the reassembly was interesting too, because the cube faces would shrink down and then the robotic parts would start to grow from inside of this bevel cage, and then they would snap into place. So if you were able to just look at it in slow motion, you would see that there's like literally the robot parts growing and snapping into place through time.
So I'm guessing, even though the render must have been pretty bad, that the complexity was in the sim and in the design and in getting it working, but the actual rendering, while probably pretty serious, wasn't in of itself like a bottleneck. Is that fair or not?
Yes, that's true. The rendering, the challenging part with the rendering was just another look dev. So we had to basically make these cubes look like they were physically present, like it was made out of a material that you could reach out and touch and scrape and really have a tactile appearance to it and feel like it was lit by the environment. That was a challenge in and of itself, but the biggest challenge really was cutting up the geometry, literally controlling how every single polygon would travel through space, extruding them, creating bevels so we'd have an interesting shading pattern, inheriting all the textures on every single facet, and then blending to the raw transformium cube as it travels through space, and then transitioning the material back to the robot or vehicle piece that was being reassembled.
Did you say what you rendered those in?
That was RenderMan.
Yeah. Right. For both the lab and the robot transitions?
Actually, for the lab simulation, that was Mantra. We had an artist, his name's Gordon Chapman,
right,
come in to the facility, who is a very skilled expert in Houdini Mantra. He had a lot of experience building shaders and lighting models, so he handled the animation as well as the surfacing and lighting for that sequence. The rest of the full-scale transformations. It was just too much for any one of our effects team to run the animations as well as do the lighting. So when we completed the hand-controlled simulation, the disassembly, the transit through space, the reassembly, we saved out per-frame caches of the geometry with texture assignments, handed that to our lighting department, and then they worked their magic on it.
Well, it's a terrific sequence visually, in both cases, and you know, it has that terrific kind of you can't kill these suckers kind of feel to it. So it's it works both in terms of the narrative and in terms of visually, aesthetically. Well, look, I just can't thank you enough, John, for taking time to talk to us. We really appreciate it. Congratulations on the film.
Thank you. Well, I appreciate the time. Thank you for the interview.